Tasha today and tomorrow will be dealing with this teaching called the teachings of the four veils. Veil meaning it's this kind of thin lace or fabric, thin piece of cloth covering up something. You know how grieving women, at least in the old days, used to have this kind of veil covering their face, or there are other traditions where they use these veils covering up the face. This teaching comes from, I don't know where it originally comes from, but the way I got it was through Kalu Rinpoche, who was a Tibetan teacher, the Kagyu school, who introduced, I think in many ways started up and introduced Tibetan teachings, especially the Kagyu teachings, in the West, and started many centers in Europe. The stupa that is next to Sengården, in a place called Sulbo, it's a Tibetan retreat center in a stupa, and that was founded by Kalu Rinpoche. And he's dead now since the, I think, late 70s. Anyway, this teaching is kind of a funny story. I was starting to vaguely remember it about a month ago and thinking maybe I should do something with it. And I had this sort of very vague memory or fantasy that it existed in a book by Kalu Rinpoche called The Four Veils. And I started to look for this book, and I even asked Shunat Sengården if she could check whether she could find that book on Amazon or something. And well, it turned out it doesn't exist, as far as we know. So I was kind of at a loss about where I got this memory that there was this teaching. And then just like a couple of weeks ago or less, I hadn't told Kanya anything about this search for the four veils. But then suddenly Kanya said to me, you know about this teaching about the four veils? I think it was something that Amala Sensei gave us a long time ago. And I was thinking about it. And then basically at the same time, we both realized that both our memories were false. That it was actually something that I received when I was in Dharamsala in 1993. There was a woman there, a Tibetan teacher, Buddhist teacher, named Sylvia Wetzel, who gave this. She had received it from Kalu Rinpoche, and she gave this teaching to the group of people who were there, including the Dalai Lama. And then I asked her if she had it on paper, and she did. So I got a paper copy, and then I found it in our apartment in Sengården. It's all papers. So now the four veils, they are also called the four veils of familiarity that cover the Dharmakaya and makes it unfamiliar. So to sort of put it very quickly together, this is teaching that says that even though the brilliance of the Buddha mind shines clearly and covers and brightens and enlightens the whole universe all the time, yet from the point of view of the small self or ego, it is as if this brilliant Buddha mind was covered up, and it's sort of covered up by these veils. And the veils then are, the first one is called ignorance or not knowing. And this ignorance or not knowing is I'm trying to make a kind of a picture here. So imagine there's a person, there's the face, the true face, and then there is this innermost veil that covers up this face, and that is the veil of ignorance or not knowing. And because of this veil, then there is a second veil that sort of becomes a second layer of cloth, and that is separation or duality. And because of that, there is also the third veil, which is of emotions, or I think Kala Rinpoche calls it troubling emotions, but it's in Sanskrit it is trishna, meaning thirst, which is a kind of a word for greed, craving, desire, hate, love, fear, and all the kinds of destructive or difficult, let's put it that, emotions that comes up. And actually it includes any kind of emotion. And because of that, there is the fourth outermost layer of covering or a veil called karma. Now you have to then imagine that you are not the face looking out through these veils, but you are sort of on the outside looking in, trying to see this face. And because these veils are not completely transparent, the layers of them together form sort of a untransparent covering, so that the true face, the true mind, the true nature is covered up, becomes invisible. Now it's also should be then clear, or should be made clear, I mean, that from the point of view of the face itself, if you could say so, that is, from the point of view of the Buddha mind, all these veils are completely transparent. They are not even separate in any kind of sense from this true mind or Buddha mind. They are, Kala Rinpoche says that they are the natural unobstructedness of the true mind. So you could also think of this as, you know, these mirrors that are on one side, they are mirrored, and from the other side they are not. So it's like glass that from one side you can see right through it, but from the other side it just reflects the light. You can't see through it. And these veils are the same. So from the point of view of the true face, they are completely transparent. But from the outside point of view, the point of view of the self or the ego, they are not transparent. You can't see through them. So that's just sort of trying to put everything in some kind of format. And now I'll just turn to this text by Kala Rinpoche. And this is what he said. We are now at a very fortunate time when we can hear the teachings of the Dharma, listen to them, and meditate on them. It is very important at this time, therefore, to have faith in the one who has given the teachings of Dharma, the Buddha, and it is also important to have firm faith in the teachings, in the Dharma itself. This is very important because if one does not have faith, then one will never believe the Dharma teachings and if one does not believe in the Dharma teachings, one will not practice them, and even if one do practice them a little, many doubts will constantly arise, and it will be of very little benefit. So even though you may not know of all the perfections and qualities of the Buddha mind, you should think that what the teacher is telling you, that the mind truly has these perfections and qualities, that this is true, and it is not likely that he or she would lie to you, that the teacher is telling the truth. Now, faith in the teaching and the teacher is extremely important in Tibetan Buddhism as a kind of a preliminary or starting point, whereas in Zen practice it's very often the opposite is kind of stated, that it's very important to have doubt. But still, even though you are doubtful and maybe even skeptical, you obviously need some kind of basic trust or faith, because otherwise, as Kalu Rinpoche says, even if you do practice, there will be so many doubts arising. You will never practice in the kind of way that comes from trust or faith, which is, means wholeheartedly, and therefore your practice will be quite of small benefit. The fact that one does practice, it could be said, even that in itself shows that at some point or some level, you do have the kind of trust or faith that you need. But as a Zen teacher, I wouldn't generally say that believe what I say, believe what the teacher is telling you. It feels more honest, I would guess, to say don't take my word for it. Find out yourself instead. And then Kalu Rinpoche continues, what are the teachings that the Buddha has given? The Buddha has said that everything arises out of the mind, both the state of cyclic existence and all sentient beings, and the ultimate state of perfection, Buddhahood. There is nothing that is outside the mind. And the Buddha also said that all sentient beings have the causal factors for the attainment of enlightenment. And this causal factor is called Tathagatagarbha, or Buddha nature. Tathagatagarbha means actually the womb of the Buddha, or the womb of suchness, actually. So this means that all sentient beings, which includes then everyone here, obviously, have the causal factors for attaining enlightenment. Causal factors means that we have the causes. We have the cause, and the effect is enlightenment. Beings have not already attained the enlightened state because of the obscurities over the mind produced by the veils, the four veils. The Buddha has therefore said that all sentient beings are themselves Buddhas, but they do not realize this due to the veils which cover the mind. Once the veils are cleared away, then all beings are enlightened. And he continues, so what is this potentiality for enlightenment, for the Buddha nature, which is present in all sentient beings throughout the six realms? First of all, this Buddha mind is empty in essence. It has no color, it has no shape, it has no form. The mind has absolutely no size. It is not possible to say the mind is several miles wide or that it is small or fine as a pointed hair. The mind is without size. The emptiness of the mind is not an emptiness which is nothing at all, which is the same as absence of something. The Buddha said that the mind is empty in as much as it has no form or shape or color, but it has the light, the radiance of its own clarity, which is the nature of the mind. The mind has clarity, which is the ability to know. The radiance, the light of the mind, is not like an electrical light or the light of the sun or the moon. It is not a form like that. It is the mind's own radiance, its own clarity. Because of this emptiness and clarity and radiance, the mind has the ability to have many different kinds of experiences and thoughts. And these thoughts, these experiences arise unobstructed. This is the unobstructedness of the mind. So this fine nature of the mind, its emptiness, which is the essence of mind, its clarity, which is its nature, and the unobstructedness, which is its form, is the causal factor for the attainment of enlightenment. It's like the seed which produces a flower. It is also, maybe it could be said that it's also, in a sense, we could call this, when we talk about the mind or the true nature and so forth, it's kind of metaphorical, or like all language. But because of this seed or germ, there is still, because of it exists the possibility to awaken. Because of this, I don't know what to call it, transcendent aspect of reality, we can transcend reality. If it were not for this, as the Buddha said, if it were not for the unborn, the unconstructed, the unfabricated, there couldn't be the born, the constructed, the fabricated, and there couldn't be a path leading to the experience of the unborn, the unmade and the unfabricated. And this unborn Buddha mind, Kala Rinpoche here says it's like a seed producing a flower. Then he goes into talking about the first or innermost veil of non-awareness or ignorance. It's called avidya in Sanskrit, and it's a very kind of basic, fundamental ignorance. Now, he says that this ignorance is the inability to see one's own true nature. He actually uses some kind of metaphor or simile here that I don't understand at all, so I'm not even going to I read it. Maybe one of you will understand it. It is, for instance, like this glass of rice. And if this glass of rice were the pure mind, then the arising of ignorance from the pure mind covers the pure nature and forms a veil over the pure mind. That doesn't really explain anything to me. He also talks about this ignorance as the natural impurity that are present in gold. But all of these metaphorical ways of looking at it, I think, kind of misses the point. From the outside looking in, there is this veil of ignorance. But if you could just see it from the other side, this ignorance or not knowing is actually the deepest kind of wisdom. It is the clarity of true mind itself. It is expressed by Bodhidharma in his famous words, "I don't know," which really expresses this deepest possible wisdom. There is all kinds of philosophical discussions in Buddhism, and actually I think there are very similar discussions in Christianity and in Islam and Judaism, talking about where this ignorance comes from. In Christianity, it's usually discussed in terms of evil. Where does evil come from? Does it come from God, or is it God, or is it separate from God? I was recently in a seminar in a church in Stockholm just a couple of weeks ago, where we talked about, there was a Orthodox, actually Finnish Orthodox Christian named Sattu, and then there was an imam from Eritrea, a Muslim, and a Jewish practitioner of some kind. She wasn't a rabbi. And then there was me. And the purpose of the discussion or talk was, do we pray to the same God? And it was a little bit difficult subject, because I won't get into that. But anyway, there was a kind of a discussion there around evil, and it turned out that there were very different viewpoints between these three Abrahamistic religions about evil and the source of evil. It seemed like the Finnish Orthodox Christian, she said that evil was a parasite in the body of the good. So that the body of God had this kind of parasite in it. And parasites are, of course, like external. There are things that have somehow sneaked in and eats and feeds. And it was kind of a strange metaphor. But I think the Muslims said it best. Well, I agreed with him most, maybe, because he said that, well, in Islam, God is both good and evil. As simple as that. Because if God is almighty, which they all agreed upon, then obviously evil must come from God too. Even if he just created it, it still must have been in him or her, so to speak, to be able to create the opportunity for evil. So it was kind of confusing. And I think there is a similar confusion in Buddhism about where does actually ignorance come from. Ignorance isn't evil, but it's certainly is the cause for what many people would call evil. So I leave that to the philosophers and continue with the veil covering not knowing. It's called the veil of duality. So Kala Rinpoche writes, and when that non-awareness obscures the mind, it does not have the ability to see or know its perfect nature. Due to the non-awareness of the mind, there arises the thought of self, I and I am. And then from the mind's clarity arises all the different senses like seeing, tasting, touching, hearing and smelling. Because the mind does not recognize its own clarity, then the mind produces this notion of others. And this clinging to self and others produces the second veil that covers the mind. This is the veil of duality or separation. As soon as the notion of others appear, in other words, then the notion of self is also there. It's kind of a, well, this, what the word duality implies, it's kind of a separation that that which inherently is united is sort of split into two different things. There appears to be an inside, there appears to be a subject, and there, because of the subject, there appears to be objects. In the affirming faith in mind, that we chanted, there is this verse saying that things are things because of mind, this mind is mind because of things, and these two are merely relative. Both at source are emptiness. And this source emptiness is this Buddha mind or this true nature. Because of this sense of duality, this sense of basically of self and that which is not self, because of this split, then appears the third veil of emotions. The emotions that are usually talked about is greed, hate and ignorance. But it is more subtle than that. He says that from the attachment to self and others, there arises liking for objects of liking and aversion for objects of dislike. And from attachment and desire arises greed and craving and clinging, addiction, dependency, and from aversion arises anger, jealousy, and fear, hate. Now, the traditional Buddhist texts on this, they state, I mean, the oldest Pali texts say that there are, for every sense impression that appears in the mind, there is a corresponding, I guess you could call it sort of almost like an automatic response. And the response is, they can be very simply divided into three possibilities. And one is a response which is kind of an affirmation. And one is a response which is like a negation. the opposite. And the third response is neutral. And these are the only three possible responses that you can have to a sense impression. Now, from the true mind's point of view, there is no problem with this. And actually, you know, if you put something sweet in the mouth, it tastes sweet. If you put something salt in the mouth, it tastes salty. Sour tastes sour, and bitter tastes bitter. And there is no problem with that. I don't know if you have watched or maybe feeded babies when they started to sort of just taste things. They're off breastfeeding and starting to just sort of have little taste portions of different stuff. And when you put something they never tasted before in the mouth, like a piece of cucumber or whatever, it doesn't matter what it is, the whole face sort of scrunches up like it was the most disgusting thing they ever tasted, and then they just keep eating it, and then they want more. I've seen this many times, and it's kind of a funny reaction. But because this, at this point, still quite subtle sense of self, what is basically just an affirmation becomes attraction. What is negation becomes repulsion. And these very neutral things becomes sort of an indifference. And according to Buddhist thinking, then, the stronger the sense of self becomes, or ego, or duality, another way of putting it, this separation into self and other, the stronger it is, the more these feelings becomes problematic. Attraction, instead of just being I like sweet, becomes I desire it, I have to have it. And it then easily turns into greed, and to clinging, craving, the kind of problems associated with that. Addiction, for example. And this repulsion, or rather the negation of something, just meaning that I don't want to go in that direction right now, becomes kind of a repulsion. And repulsion turns into all kinds of states of aggressivity, like anger and hate and strong dislikes and disgust and also fear. Because fear is a very strong repulsive feeling. And these emotions then take, it's like they're kind of illusionary states that take on a life on their own. And since our sense of separation is born, we start to identify with them. We start to believe that that's what we are. We are these emotional states. And because of that arises all kinds of delusions of mind. Indifference, the third possibility that starts with neutrality, becomes indifference, and then can become all kinds of states of what Kalu Rinpoche here calls stupidity. And stupidity in Buddhist thinking is not being conventionally stupid, like having a low IQ or something. To be stupid is to have opinions. Because what it means is that you don't really experience truth, so instead you fantasize or conceptualize it, and that is stupidity. And this stupidity in connection with this greed, hate and all kinds of negative emotions, they become, it becomes a very powerful destructive force that could easily be called evil. Opinions are, the Sanskrit word is ditti, and it kind of, it means opinions, but it can be also like ideology, you know, where you have a strong, such a strong opinion of how things are based on some kind of conceptual ideas, that you think, start to think that these opinions are more important than people and life, and so you can even, you know, kill for it. You can start to have concentration camps and start wars and do all kinds of things based on these sort of ideas. And all these ideas then, in a sense, you could say, is a try to making sense of the world you experience moment by moment. And that they very often, as we know, are used to cover up our own greed and hate and jealousy and envy and fear. So we make them into concepts instead. We fear something, we feel repulsion, so we start to fear something, and then we make it into a conceptualized kind of fear, saying that we don't like immigrants because they take our jobs or change our culture. And behind that, maybe it's just fear. Now, he says there are many kinds of emotions and attachments which form in the mind. Desire for one's body or clothing, for food, for wealth, for houses, for property, and so on. Altogether, there are 21,000 kinds of desire. This is, I have to imagine some kind of Buddhist monk sitting and counting all the desires he can think of and coming up with 21,000. And then he continues, in the same way there arise 21,000 different kinds of aversion and anger, and 21,000 different kinds of stupidity and opinions. There also arise 21,000 different kinds of combinations of these three. And therefore, together, there become 84,000 different kinds of defilements of the mind. And all these 84,000 different kinds of defilements arise from the unobstructedness of true mind. But this then produced the third veil, which obscures the mind, which is this veil of defilements, the veil of disturbing emotions. Now then, of course, again, looking from the other side, so to speak, there is really no problem here. There is just... Let's take fear, for example. I just before this last session at Sangor and September session, I was looking out through the window from my apartment there, and on the grass below, I saw a big snake, big black, the biggest snake I've seen in Sweden, I think. Because Swedish snakes don't get very big. So it was over a meter long at least, and quite fat and black. So I saw it kind of moving slowly, slowly through the grass. So I went down. And I also found Shuna, and said, let's go and look at the snake. So we went up to the snake, and it was one of those called huggorm, who, if you are bitten by them, you do get a little bit sick. I mean, they are poisonous. And it was an unusually big snake. And then when we moved towards it, because it was not doing anything, it was just lying there then, not moving at all. And we took a few steps towards it, and then suddenly it reacts like snakes can do, very, very quickly, raising its head and doing this very loud kind of hissing sound towards us. So we jumped back a couple of feet. And that's fear. But it's also something completely natural. It's not what we mean when we usually talk about fear. It's more the sort of the natural response. You know, it's like the snake is saying, all right, I'm getting uncomfortable here. If you get closer, I might have to bite you. And you're saying, okay, I'll back up a couple of feet. There's really nothing more to it. Of course, those thoughts don't go through your mind. It's just like an immediate backing up. But emotions become complicated because of the self, because of this strong sense of self and other. And then we can fear anything. We can fear life, we can fear death, we can fear relationships, we can fear not having relationships, we can fear finding out who we are, and of course, for practitioners, we can fear emptiness. Now we have one more of the veils to talk about, veil of karma, and also there's some more to be said about this when it comes to what it actually means and how you practice with these four veils and the suggestions of Kalo Rinpoche and the Tibetan tradition compared to the Zen tradition. But we will work on that tomorrow, and here we should end right now and recite the four vows.